Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument. Petitioner in the case of Advertising and Policy Committee of Avis versus Savis. We have allotted 20 minutes for petitioners, 20 minutes for respondents, and 10 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. David McAtee and Mr. John Holstead will present arguments for the petitioner. Mr. McAtee will open.
May it please the court. My name is David McAtee of the Dallas firm of Thompson & Knight. John Holstead and Vincent Elkins and I are going to be here today representing the petitioners, and we are going to divide our time equally. My argument will address the $5 million judgment levied by the Court of Appeals in this case. I will attack it on the two grounds, the grounds that the seven individuals against whom this judgment was levied were not before the court, and that there was no evidence to support the jury's finding of $5 million. To set up Mr. Holstead's argument and my argument, I'd like to give you a one-paragraph overview of this case. It's difficult to do 8 years of litigation or 9 years of litigation, but here's a try. Avis was formed in the early 1950s as a small, financially troubled company called Avis, and a small group of independent operators banded together and advertised under the common name of Avis. By 1955, Avis, the company, and these licensees entered into an agreement called the Exclusive License Agreement, whereby the licensees, through representation on the Advertising and Policy Committee, sometimes referred to here as just simply the committee, had extensive system control. By 1981, Avis, which had become quite large by that time, did not like this agreement and took over advertising and quit paying into the Advertising and Policy Joint Trust that had been set up years before. It was at that juncture that the A&P Committee, the Trust, and Vehicle Rentals, Inc., and Hayes Leasing Company, individually as corporations, and on behalf of the body of Avis licensees, brought this suit. We are here to complain that the Court of Appeals, in summary fashion, levied a $5 million judgment on seven individuals. It did so in essentially two sentences and without citing one single case or one single fact from the trial. In keeping with the style of the intermediate court, Avis, in its principal reply to our application for writ of error here on the subject points, has not cited one case to this court on which to sustain that $5 million judgment. Points 1 through 3 of our application attack the judgment rendered against seven individuals: Orwell W. Story of Texas, J. Daniel Baker of Arkansas, John R. Birch of Tennessee, Gene M. Ehlers of Iowa, Robert T. Hayes of Texas, J. N. Weinberg of New York, C. Kenneth Wright of Virginia. These individuals have at various times served as members of the committee and as trustees of the trust. To assist the court, we've adopted and brought to the court several demonstrative aids, some of which are before you, others in notebooks that have been handed to you by the clerk. The chronological chart, which is in the front of your notebook, does two important things. It identifies, and this is very critical that it does so, it identifies the parties in the court below, and in particular, the parties who were the party plaintiffs. It's important to understand that the original plaintiffs were, and always have been, the Advertising and Policy Committee of the Avis Rent-A-Car System, 2, the Avis System Advertising Trust, 3, Hayes Leasing Company, Inc., and 4, Vehicle Rentals. Notwithstanding the fact that those four named plaintiffs were the only party's plaintiffs, the Court of Appeal reached out and entered judgment against the seven individuals in what I've come to know as I've studied this record as essentially judgment by ambush.
None of these folks were ever served with a citation.
That is correct, Justice Wright. There was no service of citation. We are up here on points which the court knows include constitutional points under both the federal constitution and the state constitution. Our state constitution in Article 1, Section 19 requires that the rules of civil procedure be complied with. Our rules of civil procedure speak to this point. And as you see in my chronological chart and in my comments right here, there had to be a way for these people to be sued and served and brought into court. There couldn't have been a judgment at the Court of Appeals level by Immaculate Conception. The rules of civil procedure tell us how they got to be sued and what Avis had to do. So follow me, if you will, just a moment through the pleadings. The plaintiff's Third Amendment original petition was the petition on which these four named plaintiffs went to trial. The seven individuals against whom the Court of Appeals has levied judgment are not plaintiffs. We're not, never have been, and Avis knew that. Look in the record at Avis's answer to the Third Amended Original Petition, and they swore in paragraph 12 of their answer that the committee and the trust lacked the capacity to sue. Why? Because the individuals, trustees, were not in court. Next, I need to focus your attention on the pleading that Avis says that they sued these seven individuals. That's Avis's third amended counterclaim. If the seven individuals were ever sued, it was by virtue of that pleading. Avis's third amended counterclaim was filed against the same four named plaintiffs: the committee, the trust, Hayes Leasing Company, Inc., and Vehicle Rentals. The Third Amendment counterclaim was just that. It was a counterclaim, and it could have sued only opposing parties. Rule 97 is explicit and contains the term opposing parties in two separate provisions. It means, obviously, that a defendant here, Avis, filed a counterclaim against the named plaintiff and nobody else. So what was Avis to do? It's easy. Avis could have filed under 97F to bring in additional parties. Additional parties under 97F is quite clear. Parties other than those made parties to the original action may be made parties to a third-party action, counterclaim, or cross-claim in accordance with the provisions of Rules 38, 39, and 40. Rule 38A says, as Justice Ray has pointed out, You've got to take out citation and petition and serve it.
You said they could file a motion. They didn't need to file a motion to join new parties, did they?
Yes, they have to file under 38A, Your Honor. They have to file out a citation and petition.
You said motion.
I'm sorry.
They don't have to file a motion.
No, sir. I misspoke there. I am relying in that regard on 97F. And its relation to 38A, and I rely upon the explicit terms of those rules. It is undisputed that no citation, however, was issued or served under Rule 38A. The issue then is whether or not they took some action, the individuals took some action that placed them before the court. Two rules I want to address your attention to. Rule 120. 120 requires simply that for entry of an appearance, that a defendant in person, by attorney, or his duly authorized agent appear, but that has to be noted on the docket sheet and the minutes of the court, not done here. That rule doesn't count here. The Court of Appeals hung their hat on Rule 121. And Rule 121 simply is that rule that says that an answer shall constitute an appearance of the defendant so as to dispense with the necessity for the issuance or service of citation. No answer was filed on behalf of these individuals. The Court of Appeals glossed over that fact. At page 22 of their original opinion, the Court of Appeals incorrectly stated, when the trustees file their answer denying liability and invoke that part of the trust agreement providing that a trustee shall have personal liability only for acts knowingly committed in bad faith, they, quote, joined issue and were before the court. Simply did not happen. The answer, which is blown up in the courtroom today, was filed on behalf of the original named plaintiffs and counter defendants. I've shown that here in the highlighted terms. Why did the Court of Appeals make such a fundamental mistake? They mischaracterized that document. I wondered about that preparing for this argument. I think I found the reason. At page 6 of Avis's brief in the Court of Appeals, Avis made the following blatant misrepresentation of fact. Avis described the answer in question as follows. The licensee trustees answered in their individual capacities, citing transcript 633-640. If you go to that, that's the answer you find. No answer on behalf of the individuals. The Court of Appeals made much of a memorandum filed by Vincent and Elkins concerning who could sit in the courtroom during the trial. Incredibly, the Court of Appeals said that that was perhaps an admission. They didn't really reach the point, really didn't hold that, but they said it sure looked like they thought they were parties. 2 points. The so-called Vincent and Elkins memorandum was not filed on behalf of these 7 individuals. It goes back to the critical understanding that it was filed on behalf of those 4 original named plaintiffs and counter-defendants. More incredibly, it's not important what the memo said. It's important that the judge denied any relief and said all you individuals have to sit out in the hall. You can't even be in the courtroom. The Court of Appeals didn't mention that. Now, what's also important is that the only 2 people allowed to stay in the courtroom, Mr. Hayes and Mr. Story, were there as corporate representatives of Vehicles Rentals, Inc. and Hayes Leasing Company, Inc., and the record shows that. I don't have time to read to you Statement of Facts 485 and 489, but it is under tab 2 in your notebook right behind my chronological chart. And it will show that the judge sat there and said, in effect, Mr. Hayes, Mr. Story, you can stay because you are representative of these corporations and the licensee class. So here these gentlemen stay in the courtroom believing that their assets were not subject to the jurisdiction of that court or subject to judgment. If there's any question about anything I've said, that question was resolved on March 14, 1988, when the court entered, at Avis's request, an order drafted by Avis's attorney, in which it is recited, ordered that defendants and counterplaintiffs' allegations and prayers for relief and defendants' third amended counterclaim shall remain in effect against plaintiffs, counter-defendants, the Advertising and Policy Committee of the Avis Rental Car System, the Avis System Advertising Trust, Vehicle Rentals, Inc., and Hayes Leasing Company, Inc., in their individual capacity. This controlling order was entered 3 weeks into the trial. It speaks of allegations and prayers for relief. There's 3 separate occasions this trial judge said, you 7 individuals are not before this court. He said it when he denied any relief under the Vincent Elkins memo. He said it again on March 14, 1988, and he said it again at the end of the trial, when based on the jury's answers to 17 and 18, Avis came up and said, well, hit these guys with judgments, notwithstanding the fact there are people in Iowa and Virginia and all of the United States and in the courtroom, outside the courtroom. But the trial judge refused to do it. And that issue was raised squarely at that time. So the modified order regarding the defendant's third amended counterclaim is quite controlling in this point. My final point, in closing this part of my argument, relates to the fact that the jury was simply allowed to speculate with regard to the question, the so-called $1 million question. Only portion of the statement of facts on which anyone can try to say that there was any evidence of the $5 million is blown up on this chart. And this is testimony under cross-examination by Avis's trial lawyer, who didn't want to hear much more than this. But he was trying to find out how much money had been spent on the so-called licensee causes of action. And he says, do you know? Answer by Ms. Hinton, who was a lawyer proving up some attorney's fees from Vincent and Elkins. A very small percentage of it, Mr. Wallenberg, a very small percentage of $7.7 $1.50 million in attorney's fees and expenses that have been incurred for the entire case. There's no evidence in this record of any segregation of attorney's fees. And
at the very end of the trial, Mr. Wallenford invited the jury to speculate and to engage in conjecture as to the $5 million. Mr. Wallenford apparently was trying to make up his mind at that point and simply said, I suggest about half of these fees. Well, that might be $4 million. I don't know. Maybe that's too much. I would say about $3 million of these fees shouldn't have been spent for these licensees' claims.
The only testimony about it is found in Hinton's testimony that simply said a very small percentage of it. That concludes my remarks.
How much time is remaining?
Only 4 minutes.
According to the objection to extend the time? No. We'll give you 9 minutes and 25 minutes for.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought we were going to get a warning light for my 10 minutes.
You did.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was fast.
May
it
please the court, Mr. Holstead, will continue the argument.
My name is John Holstead. I'm with Vinson & Elkins. I tried this lawsuit. I want to set the stage for the other issues in the case that transcends the ones that we have been talking about. Situation. Avis was a small, financially troubled regional operator up in New England. Objective. Expand the rental system of Avis across the country. Avis didn't have the money to do so. The only way they could do it was by licensing. The strategy, form a constitution or a license agreement that would induce independent operators to affiliate with Avis. The problem, how to convince these independent operators to advertise and promote Avis's name instead of their own. How to convince these independent operators to comply with uniform policies and procedures so that you could establish uniformity in the operation of the system. The solution, form a joint committee representing Avis and all system licensees to handle and be responsible for advertising and policy for the system. The concept, simple, fair, a joint committee collecting money from all system members on the same basis and expending those joint funds for purposes for their mutual benefit, such as advertising. The exclusive license agreement is at the very heart of this system, has been since 1955. The issues of which this case is about and are relevant to this litigation have not changed since then. The Advertising and Policy Committee is at the very heart of this license agreement, but the Court of Appeals did not mention, in its entire opinion, Section 5.1 of the license agreement, which is the central provision of the agreement. Totally ignored it. The focus of this court, we believe, should be to determine what the intention of these parties was in 1955 when they formed this committee and entered into this agreement.
Mr. Holstead, which point are you speaking to here?
Your Honor, I am speaking on the assumption that this court, having acquired jurisdiction based on points, will consider the entire case.
Right.
Avis's president, when he testified at trial, was asked the question, can Avis dictate policy to the licensee? Answer, no. But basically what the Court of Appeals has held, despite this admission by Avis's chief executive officer, is that Avis decides system policy and that this committee is merely a consultative body. The license agreement, section 5.1, part of the agreement. There shall be a joint committee. Note the word joint. Who does it represent? It represents Avis and all system licensees. I call the court's attention to joint
the licensor, licensee. That's all members of the system. The committee shall consist of 13 members, six of whom are appointed by Avis, and the other seven elected by the licensees at convention. Each member of the committee shall have one vote. The provision goes on to say, one of the licensee members shall be elected as chairman of the licensees. The chairman shall have no vote except in the case of a tie. Indicates that majority votes make decisions. A majority of the members and their alternates shall constitute a quorum. Why require a quorum? Unless you're going to call and invite a business before it. No meeting shall be convened without written notice, unless it's waived. Again, the clear concept of the committee is that through majority votes, decisions will be made on matters within the scope of the committee's responsibilities. What are those responsibilities? The license agreement answers those questions. Responsibilities of the committee. The committee shall have full responsibility for national advertising, as set forth in Section 4 of preceding agreement. In addition, the committee shall serve as a general policy committee for what? The AIM assistant, all members of the system. And if there is any doubt about it, that this committee is responsible for making decisions, look what the last line says. The decisions of the committee shall be fully reported to the system licensees.
Court of Appeals didn't discuss 5.1. We say that the exclusive license agreement can be one of three things in this case. It can be clear in their favor, as the lower courts held. It can be clear in our favor, as we contend. Or if the court should decide that their construction of it is correct or reasonable, shall we say, and that the Court of Appeals analysis of the contract is reasonable, our construction of the ELA is at least reasonable. And if this contract is subject to two reasonable interpretations, this case has to be reversed. Now the question then becomes, can it be rendered or should it be remanded? Petitioners contend that it should be rendered because the conclusive evidence in the case was that the purpose of these provisions was so that the committee could make decisions which all members of the system would honor, and Avis offered not one witness, not one bit of evidence to the contrary. Every witness they called was employed by Avis after this lawsuit was filed in 1981. They did not join issue with us on any of the historical testimony. So if parole evidence is admissible in this case, the evidence is conclusive in our favor. Next question that I'd like to visit with Your Honors about.
Is it totally undisputed, counsel?
Sir?
Is it totally undisputed evidence? In other words, you're saying it allows us to render, and I assume it allows us to render because you're saying that the testimony that you put on about the history is totally undisputed.
That is our contention, Your Honor, and let me tell you why. We called two important witnesses to testify, a Mr. Tetrick, who was the chairman of the committee, and he was the third president of Avis, the Avis system, and was the chairman of the franchise committee that wrote this document, working with Avis's lawyer. He testified for the plaintiff. We called Mr. Fred Mudgett, who was also Avis's representative on that committee that drafted this agreement. Both of those gentlemen testified to the purpose, meaning, and intent of these provisions of the license agreement, and that the purpose, meaning, intent of it was so that the committee could make decisions by majority vote and have such force and effect that it would be binding on all system members, and that these independent operators would agree to abide by the pronouncements because their representatives were on the committee with Avis's representatives, with ours and theirs having full voting rights. There are other issues I wish I had time to address with the court.
Are you going to talk about this attorney's fee, about question 18 on rebuttal?
I can if I'm out of time. If I have some additional time in light of what the court said earlier, I'd like to do that now.
Well, we've given 5 minutes. You have 10 minutes of rebuttal, but I hope you'll spend some of that time on this issue.
I will, sir. Thank you.
May it please the court, Rufus Wallingford will be an argument for the spot. I'm sorry.
That's closer than a lot of people get.
You have 25 minutes.
I beg your pardon, now?
25 minutes.
I hate to start an argument by reading from the record, but I'm going to read, and I'm going to read quick because I think it's important. This is from the judgment rendered by the Court of Appeals. The judgment, I'm talking about the trial court judgment, is modified to reflect that the individual trustees, Baker, Birch, Eilers, Hayes, Story, Weinberg, and Wright, jointly and severally, shall pay to the Avis Trust the sum of $5 million. In the course of its opinion, the Court of Appeals said, when the trustees filed their answer denying liability and invoked that part of the trust agreement providing that a trustee shall have personal liability only for acts, quote, knowingly committed in bad faith, close quote, they joined issue and were before the court. Now, we have an opinion of the Court of Appeals ruling that the individual trustees were before the court.
Why didn't you serve it?
Judge, I've taken the position that as trustees of this trust, they were parties from the get-go.
But you didn't serve?
No, filed a counter-serve. Their lawyers counterclaim.
Why did you prepare these orders that don't have their names in them?
Sued the individual trustees, Judge. It may have been an error. My point is, where are these individual trustees that a court has held or before them?
Why did you argue that they shouldn't be in the courtroom during all of this?
Now that is an interesting point. What Mr. McAtee, who of course was not there, does not tell the court that the portion of the record dealing with the invocation of the rule occurred before Vincent and Elkins filed this motion to permit the trustees to be in the courtroom. This occurred in the afternoon. I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
This occurred in the afternoon. The rule was invoked. The judge said, okay, we'll get a representative of the trust, we'll get a representative of the licensee class members, or the representatives of the class can stay in the courtroom. I objected because Mr. Holstead said he wanted all of the class members. So there were some 90 potential class members. I said, Judge, all the class members can't be in the courtroom. And he said, well, that's right, the class representatives can't. Then the next morning, Mr. Holstead comes into court with a motion to permit the trustees to be in the courtroom because they were parties.
Is that his memorandum of law in support of parties and expert witness?
Yes, sir. And he was seeking...
Is it your contention that he was representing the trustees in their individual capacities at that time?
Sure.
Didn't you oppose that motion?
No, sir. It was never ruled on and never brought before the court, and I did not oppose it.
If he wasn't representing them in their individual capacities at that time, understanding your position, then you lose.
I beg your pardon?
If he wasn't representing them in their individual capacities at that time, then you lose.
No, sir, I don't think I lose because I don't think this court has jurisdiction to do anything about it.
Why not?
Nobody has filed a writ, an application for writ, on behalf of these individuals. That's why. Mr. Vance represents, and Mr. McAtee, he didn't say so, but what he says is he represents Vehicle Rentals, Inc., a Texas corporation. He represents Hayes Leasing Company, a Texas corporation, and that's all he represents. Mr. Vance, in response, says, admittedly, the trustees did not file a motion for rehearing or an application for writ of error. They are not before this court, and they have never been before this court, or any court. I have filed a motion to dismiss because I don't think anybody has spoken for these people. And I think that they did not file a writ, believing, and as a litigation tactic, because their motion goes on to say, Avis's motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction is a poorly camouflaged attempt to entice the trustees to make an appearance before this court, subjecting them to jurisdiction. I guess they believe that if they filed a writ, that it would subject them to jurisdiction. I don't think so. But they elected not to file an application and are arguing basically through a friend of the court. The situation is comparable to this. Let's say that I have a car wreck with the president of Exxon, and it happens in Arkansas, and he's on vacation, so I just sue him. And I sue him in Texas. He files a 128 special appearance. It's overruled. I get a judgment. And Exxon appeals. So, well, you know what you're going to do with that. These trustees against whom there is a personal judgment, simple money judgment, I submit are not before your honors. Nobody has filed a writ in their behalf, and that, I submit, is basic.
Of course, if they are before, then they're represented by counsel whom you have served with your counsel, I suppose, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
If they are before this court, they are before them represented by counsel whom you served with your counterclaim.
Fine. But that counsel says, I don't represent him. I don't know what to do. I said he did.
Isn't there a high
I don't think he can now, Your Honor, as a matter of fact. Once that judgment is entered against the individual trustees, he can no longer represent them. He could up until that point, but he can't represent both the trust and the individual trustees on in the case of a bad, when they've been found guilty of a breach of that trust. But I submit that the correctness of the Court of Appeals decision is simply not before this court. Somebody...
You didn't have to name them or serve them. They volunteered themselves in. But once they were hit, they had to... They couldn't come up to this court in the same capacity in which they were found liable for $7 million.
I don't care. I mean, somebody needs to file something and say, look, I represent these guys. In whatever capacity, as trustees or committee members, because they filed an answer.
That's the way they came into court. Under your theory, by somebody
filing... I filed suit against them as the trustees of the trust. Now, if they file an application for writ as the trustees of the trust, okay. But Vehicle Rentals, Inc. and Hayes Leasing Company is not the proper vehicle to do it.
Does the record reflect whether who of the trustees was ever present at trial, other than those who testified as witnesses?
Oh, sure. There were several there that didn't testify as witnesses that were in and out.
Does the record reflect that?
I doubt that it does, Your Honor. There were four trustees that testified. There was Bob Hayes, there was Mr. Baker, Mr. Wright, and Mr. Stoller.
Pardon, three that never participated?
I'm sorry?
Three trustees never participated in the trial?
Judge, the record will not reflect them being there. I mean, they were...
And two trustees only participated as witnesses?
Oh, no, four. Four trustees were called.
Well, two of them were present at the trial only for purposes of testifying as witnesses. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Two of the four were not in the courtroom the whole time. Exactly. That's Baker and Wright.
Surely just the appearance as a witness doesn't make
sense. No, I'm not contending that, Your Honor.
It would have been possible for other people to be there in their representative capacity, one in their individual capacity.
I'm not quarreling with that. What I say is, though, that in my position all along was when that trust became a party, the trustees were parties. It's an unincorporated association. They are parties for purposes of diversity of citizenship. In fact, they avail themselves of that. Because we removed this case to federal court, and they came in here and they said, well, now, wait a minute, we've got a trustee who is a citizen of New York.
Is that in our record?
Yes, sir. You bet. The motion to remand is in the record, is in the transcript, John.
Let me see if I follow you, your last statement. You're saying from the suit of trust, automatically, the trustees are liable in the individual capacity because they're members of the trust?
Well, sir, but I didn't sue the trust. I sued the trustees. I did not name them individually, but I said we sued the trustees of the advertising trust for breach of the trust.
But the trustees of the committee?
They're one and the same, yes, sir.
So you sue the committee. You're saying every member of the committee is individually liable because they're members of the committee?
No, I said they're individually liable because they're trustees of the trust. I didn't say that they were individually liable because they're members of the committee. They happen to be one and the same.
To me, it seems to be a stretch to say that every member of this committee is liable in individual capacity because they're members of the committee without service and without the normal things you do to bring in a person in court.
Well, Your Honor, I think I can counterclaim against them. You take a committee, you take a trust. I don't know how you serve a committee. I think I can sue the... And if I say I'm coming against the individual committee members, I'm suing the chairman of the committee and the vice chairman of this committee, and I'm suing the trustees, in this particular case, the trustees, and they come in and they file an answer that could only apply to the individuals. It says, pursuant to the terms of the Avis System Advertising Trust, the licensee members of the Advertising Policy Committee and the trustees of the trust cannot be liable for the claims alleged. Now you go back to the terms of the trust and you find the usual exculpatory language saying that they're going to be liable only for self-dealing or acts done in bad faith. That was the way the jury issue was submitted. I say they came in twice and sought relief. They came in federal court and said one of the parties here, and it's the diversity of citizenship of the parties, is a New York resident, so please remand this case, and they were successful in doing so. Then during the trial, they come in again and said, we want to be in attendance, and file the motion to come in and
the motion that you met was never ruled on, and the two of these witnesses sat outside.
Judge, I don't know if they sat, I don't know where they were. I saw them around the courthouse. They were in and out. They were in here, I mean, but that's not going to be in the record, so it doesn't make any difference. They were not, all of the trustees, Your Honor, were not present at the trial.
But ordinarily, you would, if you're going to sue somebody individually, you would say that I, you know, file my petition against John Doe individually and as trustee. And when this court gets sued, ordinarily, every member is served individually. People usually
want to be involved. I'm sorry to hear that. You need a lawyer.
They usually take the trouble and
what it is that got them, they weren't named, they weren't served. Why is it that they're enforced?
Well, Your Honor, I think they're before you because I think they entered an appearance.
What did they do to constitute entering an appearance? This memorandum, is that part of that?
That's part of that. Absolutely, it's part of that. Their answer itself is part of it.
What is their answer?
Paragraph 15 of their answer says, pursuant to the terms of the trust, the licensee members of the Advertising and Policy Committee and the trustees of the trust cannot be liable for the claims alleged by defendant. Me.
So you're saying licensees means individuals?
The licensee members, yes, sir. Means the individuals, and then when you go on and say, and the trustees, now we know who those were. There's no doubt about it. Everybody knew Hugh was a trustee.
But doesn't that give them a status as a trustee, one that's different from an individual?
Well, Judge, I don't know how you can be a trustee in one capacity and then be not, and then when somebody says, well, you fouled up as a trustee, you said, wait a minute, I'm here just in my capacity as a trustee. That's precisely why we're suing you. You were a trustee, and you fouled it up. So I think I'm certainly entitled to sue you, and I don't have to name you, and I can counterclaim against you without any service.
The trust.
When I'm suing you for something that you have done in your capacity as a trustee, that's what I sued them in their capacity as trustees. They spent this money improperly was the basis of my claim.
Well, If they didn't spend the money wrongfully, then the trust would have to pay their legal fees. If they spent the money wrongfully, then the trust can't pay their legal fees or the judgment. Is that true?
Well, what legal fees, Judge? Because they didn't have any. That was what I was griping about, is that they took the trust funds and spent them They spent almost $8 million prosecuting this case out of this trust. My theory on that is that the great majority of the causes of action that were asserted against my client were properly those of the licensees and not the committee or the trust. We get, and this is perhaps a good entrance into the damage theory, they're griping about the damages. My position was the trust should not be spending money for a breach of a contract to which the trust is not a party. The trust should not be spending money for the construction of a contract to which the trust is not a party. The individual licensees are the parties to this contract, and they are the ones that should be financing this litigation. Now, on my damages, the jury found, in response to a question submitted by Mr. Holstead, that $5,250,000 was a reasonable sum for those causes of action to which the law permitted the recovery of attorney's fees.
All the evidence there is to support that what Mr. McAtee referred to earlier?
Mr. McAtee, they had what they had was Paula Hinton, Vince Nelkins, who testified that of the $8 million, $5 million, I think just precisely that number was allocable to breach of contract and declaratory judgment, which were the only two.
Something other than what we thought. You say the number $5 million is in the testimony.
$5,250,000 is, Judge.
Not in the jury's answer, but in the testimony.
No, it's in the jury's answer and in the testimony.
So you're saying what he put up there is all the testimony is not correct. There's something else. Can you point to the transcript where we can find the evidence supports this jury answer?
Certainly, Your Honor. It is found in the testimony of Mrs. Hinton and in the testimony of Bill White. Okay?
Can you give us page numbers?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't have the record before me. I certainly can, and I'll be happy to provide the court with a letter.
You can provide a letter.
Yes, sir. But hear me out on this. They said, all right, Ms. Hinton was at Benson Elkins and said, I've looked at all of our legal fees in this case, and $5,250,000 is properly attributable to what? Our claims for breach of contract and our claims for declaratory judgment. Mr. Bill Wilde of Bracewell Patterson came in behind her, said, I've been practicing a long time. I'm familiar with all the bills. They're reasonable. Got off the stand. That's precisely my point, is that the breach of contract action and the declaratory judgment action should not have been paid for by the trust. It should have been paid for by the individual licensee. So when the jury answers $5 million, I don't have any problem with it being supported by the evidence. That's almost precisely the amount of money that the other side admits they spent on these causes of action that should have been funded by the individual licensees and not the trust.
What about the duty of segregation?
Judge, I'm talking damages here. I'm not talking about attorney's fees here. Certainly in attorney's fees, you have to segregate between what is recoverable and what isn't.
Measure damages to the attorney's fees,
No, it's whatever they spent.